tear gas is no laughing matter. Find out why.
As I write, highly civilized human beings are flying overhead trying to kill me. They do not feel any enmity against me as an individual, nor I against them. Most of them, I have no doubt, are kind-hearted, law-abiding men who would never dream of committing murder in private life. On the other hand, if one of them succeeds in blowing me to pieces with a well-placed bomb, he will never sleep any the worse for it.
I don't talk much to friends about the war, about the bombing, partly because, well, I suppose it subverts my ageless posturing, but also because my memories of it, they're mundane, really. All I seem to remember is my Mickey Mouse gas mask, and I remember crouching with Mother underneath the dining room table when there was no time to run down the garden to the Anderson shelter, and I remember collecting shrapnel on the way to school, all that. And the vague sense I had at the time that it was somehow all my fault. Well, these memories remained, indistinct until this week when I came across a quotation in a new book about the history of aerial bombing, a quotation dealing with the impact of colonial bombing upon naive and innocent people. This is how the quote went. From the ground, every inhabitant of the village is under the impression that the occupant of an aeroplane is actually looking at him, establishing the impression that all their movements are being watched and reported. And I suddenly thought, yeah, that was it, of course, because even though I was tiny at the time, I'd been brought up to believe in a sky god who had an infallible, unrestricted access to my imperfections. For me, crouched under the table, this wrath from the skies had none of that Orwellian impersonality. It could only have been a divine reproof. Aerial bombing and its various meanings and significance. Well, that's the subject of a new book called Governing from the Skies, and its author, Thomas Hippler, is a philosopher and historian at the University of Normandy, and he's now with me in the studio. Thomas, let's just go back to a very interesting little quotation there about how the first victims of bombing must have felt, you know, as if they were always being looked at from the air, personally surveyed. That has tended to be the desired effect of aerial power, hasn't it? That's the fear that one wants to induce with it. Ever since the very beginning, the first aerial bombing in 1911, take me back to that, because it was almost an accident, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yes. The Italians were trying to conquer a colonial empire, them too, and they had recently acquired some airplanes and sent them to Africa. But nobody knew by that time quite precisely what to do with these new devices. And so one pilot, Giulio Gavotti, took kind of private initiative to throw bombs at a camp where a couple of days before that he had seen some insurgent fighters gathering.
So he just dropped them out of his plane, just
absolutely
first time. So suddenly, I mean, only a couple of years later after this, after, if you like, almost the invention of bombing, World War One breaks out and air power is going to play a pretty big role. What kind of scale are we talking about in World War One?
Well, it was during World War One that air power was developing its technological possibilities. And by the end of the war, there were actually plans that had been set up to wage an aerial offensive against the Axis powers, the central empires, which has never been carried out because they capitulated before. But during these 4 years of conflict, the technological possibilities evolved.
And so bombing was taking place.
Bombing was taking place, yes.
And we've got... You talk about the ways in which the image of the airman becomes rather important here. They become almost mythical saviour figures.
It was indeed, yes. It was kind of born out of the desire to, in a situation of tactical storm at the front, and where it was perceived to become impossible to break through, there was kind of an idea that salvation had to come from above. And so the airmen were invested with his mission of having the power to break the conflict or bring the conflict to a decision.
I mean, and then of course the significant moment, a very good interesting turning point in your book, is comes when Germany is bombing London in June and July 1917. The first time you point out, on European soil at least, when civilians were the explicit target.
That was indeed a crucial crucial development in Europe, something that had always been done in colonial warfare, targeting deliberately civilians, had come to be ruled out in Europe as where war had to be waged in principle against enemy armies alone.
So was there some outcry against this? This was regarded as really going beyond.
Indeed, yes, yes. There was some kind of debate even within Germany, and in the first time the Kaiser forbade these attacks, fearing the negative image on Germany's image in the world, and afterwards, seaborne bombardments against coastal towns, these things came to be possible, but there was a huge outcry.
But even though I think you argued the aerial bombing had pretty limited success in World War One, but by the end of that war, there was a very strong belief that air power was going to be absolutely critical to resolving any future conflicts.
That's a very interesting point indeed, yes, absolutely. Those who are arguing for air power thought that two things were crucial there. First of all, the technological development. That what had not been possible a couple of years ago will be possible in a couple of years with much bigger devices. And the second argument they brought forward was, right, of course, air power had limited effects, but this is just because we didn't implement it properly.
If we bombed much more, the war could have been over much quicker. It could have been over much quicker. Then, I mean, you mentioned the colonial, I mean, the use of bombing. I mean, the leading colonial powers. Just say a few more words about that. I mean, the idea of using bombing to suppress colonial insurgencies.
Yeah, that's a crucial development in the air power history. The most telling example is certainly the territory which is today known as Iraq, which was taken over by the British from the Ottoman Empire during the First World War, and basically the British didn't have the financial means to occupy the territory properly, and this is why it was placed under the authority of the Air Ministry, and the RAF was in charge of controlling this territory, which could be done from the air much cheaper than by proper occupation. And this was just done that in case of insurrections, the insurgent tribes were bombed. Basically.
And presumably not only cheaper, but there's also likely to be less protest against the bombing of these peoples rather than the bombings of people in Western countries.
Exactly. Where the bombing of London, for instance, had provoked a huge popular outcry. Nobody cared about what is going on in the colonies, which is pretty much in line with what had been going on for a long time, where colonial warfare had always consisted not in defeating an enemy army, but in terrorising a civil population.
And then, of course, it comes home from the colonised to the colonialists with the start of World War II. And you say we're no longer talking now about a battle between states, we're talking about a battle between peoples.
That's a crucial development that already occurred during the First World War. That's one of the crucial lessons learned from this conflict, because precisely it was impossible, proved to be impossible to break through the front. Mm. And therefore, air power offered the possibility to circumvent this front and to hit not the armies anymore, but the sources of their power behind the front.
But, I mean, that idea of really bombing people into defeat, the popular perception that you could do it, I mean, it really turned out the bombing was actually rather less important than one might think during World War II.
Absolutely, and we have precise evidence on that. It was more. It was most importantly the U.S. Air Force that conducted after the war a huge assessment, the United States Bombing Survey, on the effectiveness of aerial bombing. And while it did have some effects on transportation system, for instance, its effect on the morale of the civil population was definitely not that important.
Very interesting. But of course, the idea of using massive bombing was still continued after the war, despite its ineffectiveness. I mean, I suppose in Vietnam. But this did engender a sort of lack of public support. It made it difficult to go on, that bombing campaign, that almost seemed endless bombing campaign.
This was a critical point indeed for the US military in Vietnam, that one important factor which made that they lost the war was obviously that public support at the home front was lacking, and the Vietnamese were consciously trying to undermine this public support.
Let me bring in my next guest now, just comment upon some of the things that you've been saying. I mean, he's Steve Graham, Professor of Cities and Society at Newcastle University. I mean, Thomas has been talking very interestingly about the physical devastation, loss of life caused by bombing. But I mean, you've written about the power of gravity, the way that the bombers may come to feel about the bomb. Expand on this a bit for me.
Well, yes, I think the history of bombing is very much the history of using gravity to lob high explosives onto the ground. We forget that that's the sort of basis for bombing. And it resonates with long histories in Western languages and cultures and theologies where to be above is to be seen to be superior. And that's very interesting in the very language that we use about poverty and wealth and happiness. You know, to be above is to be superior. It's the word superior itself means above. To be below is to be down and to be depressed. The word down actually is a term for depression. The word low is a term for deceit. So the history of bombing and the history of military uses of these technologies really exploits that in the way it sort of glamorizes bombing, in the way it glamorizes the weapon systems of bombing, in the way they put the Greek sort of mythology onto aircraft sides and so on.
I suppose in my childish way, my sort of sense of this was God, you know, seeking some retribution against me, sort of captures that meaning as well. You know, something high in the sky really is morally superior in some sort of way.
Well, I mean, the US Air Force for a while, I don't think it does at the moment, but it did have the strap line, and believe it or not, air forces have strap lines in the United States, which was above all full stop. You know, which is exploiting that connection extremely powerfully.
I know we'll come back and talk about this a little bit more a little bit later, but thank you both for the moment.
Thank you.
Now come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. Why, man, this is war, a go-go. There's plenty of good money to be made. Supplying the army, rules of the trade. Just open, David, if they drop the bomb, we're dropping on a Viet Cong. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam, and it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, you all gonna die.
Yes, Country Joe and the Fish, a reminder of the late 60s, the time of the anti-Vietnam protests and the time of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago when, as some of you remember, Mayor Daley ordered the police to exert control over the thousands of protesters with this weapon of choice, as chronicled at the time by a reporter. A reporter wrote this: "Gas, gas, gas," was the cry, as if poisonous snakes had been loosed in the area. Thousands streamed across the park and panic started, headlong running, the sudden threat of being trampled by your own people. The tear gas was catching up with us, a sharp menthol sort of burning on the cheeks and burning in the eyes. But though some people ran from it, most of us kept on just walking. But now the tear gas began really burning, making the eyes twist tightly closed, and if you rubbed it, the burning got worse, as if your eyeballs were being rolled in fire. Well, it's perhaps telling that when I read that description in a new book, I was surprised, shocked even, by the severity of the symptoms. Had I somehow grown so accustomed to the use of tear gas as a weapon of crowd control that I'd become, well, complacent about its character and about its effect? Well, these are questions for my next guest. She's the author of Tear Gas, From the Battlefields of World War I to the Streets of Today. And she's Anna Feigenbaum, who's Senior Lecturer in Media and Communication at Bournemouth University. I mean, what is tear gas chemically?
Well, usually we think of it under the umbrella term lacrimatory agents, and that's from the Latin. That means to tear. Though that name is a little bit part of the reason why we don't understand the severe effects, because thinking about tearing, a bit of a cry, you know, we're a bit sad. We don't really think about that as being a really extreme medical condition of being psychological and physical torture, which is actually what toxic gases are. And so we usually use the term tear gas to refer to CS, CN, and CR, which are just names for different kinds of chemical compounds that have these effects, as well as OC or pepper spray. And some of the things that these gases do are they affect the mucous membranes, which is what makes the tearing and the snotting. Mm-hmm. But then they also burn the throat. They cause vomiting, nausea. They cause digestive problems, diarrhea. They also more severely can cause miscarriages, respiratory problems, and lead to things like stampeding and trampling.
Now, you, rather like Thomas, have also done like a historical look at the way in which this particular weapon this developed. I mean, the use of toxic chemicals, I mean, does go back a long time, but I think the first large-scale use of tear gas was in the First World War. What was it being used for then? What was the context of its use?
Well, one of the problems that's been well documented from a military perspective with the First World War was that trench warfare created a kind of stalemate in which neither side could advance. And so they began to sort of experiment with the creation of gases that would get people out of the trench, disorient them in order to be able to lob more poisonous gases or artillery fire at them.
To get them out of the trench. I've got here, this is a reading from 1921. This is the American technology writer Theo M. Knappen writing in the Trade magazine on the assumed advantages of tear gas.
The tear gases appear to be admirably suited to the purpose of isolating the individual from the mob spirit. He is thrown into a condition in which he can think of nothing but relieving his own distress. Under such conditions, an army disintegrates and a mob ceases to be. It becomes a blind stampede to get away from the source of torture. Nobody can travel very fast in a narrow street or in the midst of obstacles with streams of burning tears flowing from his eyes. An advantage of the milder form of gas weapons in dealing with a mob is that the responsible officer need not hesitate to use his weapons.
Now, some interesting descriptions there of what he does. You know, it isolates, leads people to move away from any group solidarity at all because they've become so absurd with their own things. You talk about how, I mean, the sense of tear gas being used on the battlefield, but let's talk about its move into peacetime, because I think the US Chemical Warfare Service developed tear gas grenades for use in riot control as early as 1919. Going back, I mean, was there public resistance to the idea of this being used? How was this notion received?
I think in the United States, there was a bit of an open market. I mean, for lots of the reasons we already think of as the kind of frontier U.S. But also because the U.S. went into the war quite late, because 10% of chemists were enlisted into the war service in the U.S., there was a real boom in the chemical industry, and there was a real desire, both corporately and militarily, to make these weapons usable for peacetime. And so the leader of the Chemical Warfare Service and some of his kind of buddies, lawyers, public relationships specialists, contacts that he had at major news outlets, started a campaign lobbying prison guards, banks, and, of course, law enforcement.
So there was a commercial push behind it. I think it was used against labor protesters after the Depression, one of the first uses.
Yes, that was the kind of most important way of needing to regain social control at that time, the 1920s and 1930s. One of the mass uses was against Bonus Army veteran protesters in Washington, D.C. in 1932.
And then we're back to where we were talking about colonialism before, about Britain becoming rather central to the story of the development of tear gas. This is in the context of independence struggles.
Yes, in the colonies, and as we heard a little bit about from Thomas before, it was cheaper to use tear gas and to use these kinds of weapons than it was to have other kinds of occupational control. And there are these two major problems that were facing the British. The first was passive resistance, and the second was what they called the woman problem, women being on the front lines of protest in the kind of independence movements. And so they needed something, as Brits at home started to pay more attention, that could make them still look like they were benevolent occupiers, but at the same time could control and break the mob spirit that we heard about before.
And it reduces the sort of look of violence of the mob. I mean, people are personally attending to their eyes and so on. All that sort of like idea of crowd violence disappears. They become individuals again. I mean, it's used in the British context, though. I mean, actually sort of within, was hardly encountered really until perhaps the Northern Ireland Troubles in the 70s, as you point out. I've got a clip here of a panorama programme. This is from 1970, which featured what came to be known as the Battle of the Bogside.
On top of a 10-storey block of flats in Rossville, a group of youths under the Irish Republican flag held a commanding and unassailable position. From here throughout the day, they bombarded the police below with homemade but effective petrol bombs. Below, the police replied with the only weapon that was effective, tear gas, the first time it's ever been used to quell a riot in the United Kingdom. Ironically, the tear gas seemed to have very little effect on the riots. Its main effect was to drift into the low-lying areas of the embattled bogside, which looked like the centre of a besieged city. Here, the tear gas was more of a nuisance to the women and children than a deterrent to the combatants.
You say that this use in the Battle of the Bogside did help to place a bit more attention on the possible risks, because there was something about the nature of how it was used there.
Well, it brought moral panic to the UK, and all of a sudden this weapon that was being used in other parts of the world came home for Brits. And it led to a massive medical inquiry, and that medical inquiry did a bunch of looked at clinical trials that had already been done. But one of the things that happened was they said, let's not think of this as a weapon, let's think of this as a drug. And so they started to evaluate its effects in the way that a pharmaceutical company looks at a drug. And so all of a sudden, those kinds of corporate military interests become really embedded in the medical evaluation of whether or not tear gas is safe.
So really, there's a big commercial impetus behind the argument that it is safe, that it's not doing any harm. And we don't really have a proper inventory of the risks or of the consequences?
Yes, I think that's one of the major problems, is if we think about this kind of akin to the tobacco industry or to the sugar industry, and we think about what has come out decades later about how those products actually affect people. And I think that we will likely in a few decades see something similar with tear gas if it comes under real scrutiny.
Let me bring you back in a moment, Steve. I mean, CS gas hasn't been, as we said, routinely deployed on the British mainland, leaving aside this Northern Ireland example. I mean, this gives cause for complacency. I mean, do you feel perhaps the days of tear gas or tear gas being used on the streets, you know, is unlikely?
It's relatively uncommon in the UK these days, excuse me. But I think we have to look at the role of UK arms and defence and security companies who are at the heart of global trade in these things. The so-called non-lethal weapons, which are very often very far from being non-lethal, it's a huge growth industry in the military-industrial complex globally.
OK, well, thank you for the moment. I want now to revert, just going back to the very first topic, the topic of aerial bombardment, because in order to bring our discussion up to date, really, we must look at least briefly, perhaps at the most recent manifestation of air power, the drone. This question of accountability and public being concerned by what's going on, you say, has been somewhat mitigated by the arrival of the drone.
Indeed, and I would argue that one of the main advantages of drones for governments using them is that they enable them to wage missions that are comparable to war fighting, but that are below the threshold of what the public opinion perceives as being war.
It's interesting. I mean, asking you, Steve, I mean, these studies that we've been listening to, the one about tear gas and aerial bombing, I mean, they're distinct histories and meanings, but I think you'd want to sort of connect them in a way. I mean, you've got this concept of military urbanism. Tell me how you might connect these stories.
Well, I think my work on military urbanism very much brings together techniques like drone warfare, like tear gas proliferation, within a sort of broader idea that militaries and security forces are getting preoccupied with how to control cities. We're living in an urbanised context. The planet is becoming highly urban, and the security problem for many of these forces is to control huge masses of people in cities. And that's why the sort of chemical warfare of tear gas is becoming so prevalent, because struggles are over the right to cities, they're over democratic protests in cities, like in places like Istanbul and so on. And tear gas becomes a very effective means to dissuade and intimidate those sorts of movements.
And we're talking about news. I mean, some have argued, I think, that Google Earth represents some sort of a militarized way of looking at the Earth. What do we mean by that?
Well, I think what's interesting is how many of our routine technologies that we carry around in our smartphones, in our pockets these days, are actually, they have military origins. They use military systems, but in ways that we forget. I mean, for example, every time you use a GPS system to navigate your car around a road system, you're using the same 24 satellites that are run by the US Air Force with a bunch of atomic clocks that are being used to power the drones, to target the drone strikes. It's the same system.
Yes, you sort of draw attention to the way in which we don't think about the air and what is going on in the air as worthy of consideration.
Well, I think this is very relevant to Anna's work, because philosophers have been accused in recent years of really neglecting the air. That's true, isn't it? I mean, the sense that it's been taken for granted as a sort of invisible given. But once it becomes weaponized, as Anna demonstrates, going back to World War One, it becomes quickly apparent that without it in a couple of minutes, we all expire. Think of the global urban pollution crisis.
So, Thomas, if I turned to you and said, what is the future of aerial bombardment? I mean, how would you respond?
I don't know. I think that the road we're taking with the massive use of drones is very likely to be continued.
And what about you, Anna? Do you see tear gas? I mean, do you feel the possibility of it being used on the mainland, think it being used domestically, is still far away?
I think it depends on what happens in terms of social unrest. I think, as Stephen was just saying, you know, when these things happen in cities, then law enforcement struggles to recontrol the atmosphere. And these industries, when we look at them from a corporate perspective, they're massively growing. They're making billions and billions of pounds. And it doesn't look like there's any sign of that letting up.
I mean, you've got some figures. I mean, the colossal amount of tear gas being ordered. I think you were looking at Turkey, for example, weren't you? The amount that was being used in a particular short space of time.
Mm-hmm. And because, again, tear gas is cheap and other less lethals are much cheaper than other forms of weapons, we tend to see them rolled out quite quickly and often without that much reflection, and always compared to the fact that we are good, we are benevolent because we aren't shooting people.
So anyway, we've got sort of two patterns here. We've got the sort of the air pattern, if you like. I mean, the possibility of cyber attacks where things like bombing and so on are being used as metaphors in relation to that, and the sort of domestic on the streets scenario being described by you, Anna. Well, thank you all very much. Anna Feigenbaum, Thomas Hippler and Steve Graham, thank you very much. Now, next week on this programme, I'm going to be talking to one of the world's most frequently cited social scientists. He's been on the programme two or three times before. He's a man whose online lectures on Marxist Capital have attracted a universal audience. I was just checking today and trying to find out it's over, I think, a million people who've actually gone and looked at Marxist Capital, Books 1 and Book 2, with the help of this man. He's an academic who's now at the age of 82, and he's added just one more volume on Marx, talking about Marx's attitude towards the economy and the present-day nature of neoliberalism. He's added that volume to his already Wikipedia-busting bibliography. You'll have recognised him by now. It is, of course, David Harvey. But right now, let's all relax. Well, I do hope you enjoyed that programme. And if you'd like to hear something similar, why not try downloading the In Our Time podcast at bbc.co.uk/radio4.